Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the latest on the investigation into multiple deadly bombs in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday at churches and hotels.
Obviously, the Christian churches were vulnerable, and if you were going to do an attack on a church, clearly a time when there's going to be large congregations is the best time to do it.
Sudanese protesters vow to remain on the streets despite military warnings. Also ahead, a memoir started by musician Prince in the weeks before his death will be released in October. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, suspected suicide bombers set off explosions in at least seven churches and hotels in Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, on Easter Sunday, killing 292 people and wounding nearly 500. The vast majority of the victims were Sri Lankan, but many from the island nation's Christian minority. 32 foreigners were also killed. At least four of them were U.S. citizens, according to the State Department. Police said 87 bomb detonators were also found at the city's main bus station. Joining us to understand how and why this may have happened is Clive Williams, professor of national security and criminality at the Australian National University. My understanding is that Sri Lankan intelligence had warned of a possible terrorist attack about 10 days before this happened.
I believe the Indian Intelligence Bureau notified the Sri Lankans on the 9th of April, and then they put out an alert to senior police officers on the 11th of April that there was a warning about a potential attack on the Indian High Commission in Colombo and also against Christian places of worship. As far as I can see, there wasn't any upgrade to security at churches, because presumably they didn't take it seriously enough. The security authorities in Sri Lanka are Sinhalese, and the majority of the population is Sinhalese Buddhist. And I think if there had been a threat against Sinhalese Buddhist temples, then there might have been more of a reaction. But I think that because it was Christian churches that were being threatened, or had it been Muslim mosques, being Buddhist temples, they might have taken more precautions. But it depends on the weight they put on the information. I mean, they might have felt that wasn't very credible, even though it came from a credible source, and that, it wasn't worth taking additional precautions on the basis of that. Obviously, the Indian High Commission, if the information had come from India, is more likely to have beefed up its security. It may have been a reason why they didn't get targeted, but obviously the Christian churches were vulnerable, and if you were going to do an attack on a church, clearly a time when there's going to be large congregations is the best time to do it. The hotels, if it was intent to kill foreigners as well, then the hotels, international hotels, were a good place to target at the same time.
Do you think they didn't take it seriously because they were Christians and they don't care as much?
It's possible that it would have been taken more seriously if it had been Buddhist temples involved, but I can't really say. I mean, that's just speculation.
So far, no one has taken responsibility, but there have been arrests. Do they know who's responsible for this?
The government says it was a local group, the NTJ, but it wouldn't have been something that they would have been capable of on their own, I don't think. So the likelihood, therefore, is that there were people on the ground in Sri Lanka who were more expert, who helped the NTJ, or people came in from outside. And, of course, there have been people come back from the fighting in Syria and Iraq from Islamic State to Sri Lanka. And this is Sri Lankans who went there to fight from 2015 onwards and have returned subsequently, because there are local chapters of Islamic State in Sri Lanka. So it could have been people who were experienced who helped them put together the attacks, because it's been mentioned that there were seven suicide bombers involved. So it was obviously very well organized and very well coordinated, because all of the six attacks took place in very close time proximity. So it looks like it was very well organized, orchestrated, and the devices all seem to function effectively. So it was clearly quite professionally done.
So then why go through all of that and then not claim responsibility?
If it was the NTJ as claimed by the government, then maybe they've been off balance, because the police have been rounding them up and moved quickly to deal with them. There's also been a clamp on media dissemination and Facebook and those sorts of things. I tried to access one of the websites in Sri Lanka that was, I thought, might be quite good for reporting. It was an e-newspaper type website, and they were blanked out. So clearly it might have been that the capability to broadcast was pretty limited.
What is the NTJ? DJ?
It doesn't really have much of a profile. It's described as a local radical group that exists in Sri Lanka and in southern India. It wasn't apparently on the radar of the local security authorities as a group. They have 37 groups that were on their proscribed or extremist list in Sri Lanka, and it wasn't on that list. So I suspect that it was an organization that they hadn't really thought was particularly threatening.
How much backlash will authorities face for not offering any protective security at churches and hotels that were targeted?
Well, they'll have an inquiry because of it being an intelligence failure, and certain recommendations will come out of that, I suppose. And I don't know whether the head of the state intelligence service will be forced to resign or not. Hard to say. It depends on whether they need to be looking around for scapegoats. But at this stage, I don't think they've actually said what they're going to do. But in Sri Lanka, they've been generally reluctant to acknowledge when they've been in the wrong. You know, there have been a number of instances where the Sinhalese have been involved in war crimes or abuses against the minority elements there, and they've always resisted engaging in any kind of inquiry or reconciliation process.
That's Clive Williams, Professor of National Security and Criminality at the Australian National University. The United States is ending sanctions waivers on five countries importing Iranian oil, hoping to choke off Tehran's main source of revenue. Iran was swift to respond, threatening to close the strategic Strait of Hormuz, a major shipment artery in the Middle East, if it can't export oil. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more reaction from the countries most affected by the U.S. action, including China and Turkey.
The United States is no longer granting any exemptions from U.S. sanctions on Iranian oil imports. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the new policy Monday, saying that after giving countries time to reduce their imports of Iranian oil, the U.S. is going to zero.
Look, with the announcement today, we've made clear our seriousness of purpose. We are going to zero. How long we remain there at zero depends solely on the Islamic Republic Iran's senior leaders. We've made our demands very clear to the Ayatollah and his cronies. End your pursuit of nuclear weapons. Stop testing and proliferating ballistic missiles. Stop sponsoring and committing terrorism. Halt the arbitrary detention of U.S. citizens.
Iran responded defiantly, threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz, a strategically important choke point, if it is prevented from using it to sell its oil. Turkey also rejected the U.S. move, with Ankara's foreign minister tweeting, "The U.S. decision to end sanctions waivers on Iran oil imports will not serve regional peace and stability, yet will harm the Iranian people." Turkey rejects unilateral sanctions and impositions on how to conduct relations with neighbors. China had a similar reaction, with the foreign ministry spokesman saying China opposes the U.S. imposition of unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction. Analysts warn the oil crackdown could provoke a showdown between the U.S. and Iran and could imperil U.S. trade talks with China. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Tensions are rising again between Sudan's military and protesters who've held weeks-long sit-in around army headquarters in Khartoum. As Naba Mohideen reports, the protesters have vowed to stay until the country returns to civilian rule.
Sudan's Transitional Military Council on Monday warned protesters it plans to clear the streets around the defense ministry. Meanwhile, protesters called for an even bigger demonstration, raising the risk of confrontation. After weekend talks with protest leaders broke down, the military council issued a statement calling for barricades around the sit-in, which started April 6, to be immediately removed. The group leading the protest, the Sudanese Professionals Association, suspended talks with the military Sunday because it refused the SPA's demand to promptly hand power to a civilian council. SPA member Faisal Saleh says the protesters had already made a list of civilian leaders they wanted. But at the meeting with the Transitional Military Council Saturday, he says the situation was deadlocked, so they decided to postpone the announcement of the names and suspended talks with the Military Council, says Saleh. The military council, which replaced ousted former President Omar al-Bashir on April 11, is under pressure to return civilian rule after announcing a two-year transition period. Despite the removal of Bashir, protesters note the military council includes allies of the longtime president. They question the military's intentions and refuse to end their 4 months of demonstrations until the country is under civilian leadership. Protester Adam Yassin says he was actually expecting those steps from the military council, as long as it includes groups loyal to the former regime with the same ideology. Political analyst Al-Fatih Mahmoud says deadlock is expected after 30 years under Bashir. He says he expects new horizons to be unlocked in front of the young protesters. Political powers will try to form themselves and find a way to express the will of the Sudanese people. Sudan's protests began in December because of fuel and food shortages, but quickly morphed into demands for Bashir to step down. A military coup finally removed him 11 days ago. Sudan's military authorities said Bashir was moved last week to a federal prison, and many of his loyalists were detained or replaced. Naba Mohiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. How green jobs will affect America's economy. North Korea confirms Kim Jong-un will visit Russia for a summit with Vladimir Putin. The U.S. is closing off the spigots to Iranian oil. And the U.S. offers a $10 million reward for information on Hezbollah finances. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. More than 1 billion people in 192 countries have taken part in Global Day of Political and Civic Action for Earth Day Monday. People marched, planted trees, cleaned up cities, parks, beaches, and waterways, and politicians announced policies, while corporations pledged to work towards sustainability, all to mark Earth Day 2019. The Earth Day Network, the organization that leads Earth Day observances worldwide, designated 2019 to be the year of Protect Our Species. Earth Day brings, in general, a greater awareness to environmental concerns. The Pew Research Center released a report last week that found climate change the top concern in half the countries it surveyed last year. Joining us to talk more about Earth Day, which began in 1960, and how it's taking on more significance than ever, is Peter Glick, climate scientist and co-founder of the Pacific Institute.
The environmental movement in the United States came out of the 60s when we realized that air and water quality were really sort of collapsing around us. And Earth Day was a reflection of that growing awareness. Lots of good things have come out of that. You know, the Clean Water Act came out of Earth Day and that environmental movement in the late 60s and the early 70s, and the Clean Air Act. And we tackled the ozone layer, and we tackled acid rain, and we made great progress. But there are a lot of really bad things still happening, in particular, of course, global climate change. Despite the progress we've made, there are major environmental challenges that are not only going unaddressed adequately, but are not getting the attention from our politicians that they deserve.
And it sounds like, from all the warnings from scientists and experts around the world, including yourself, that this is not something that can wait any longer. So on Earth Day, on the one hand, it's great that we're paying attention to something that we need to pay attention to, which is this only planet we have. But on the other hand, it shouldn't be just a once a year, one day out of the year thing that we think about.
That's right. For some of us, every day is Earth Day, or every day ought to be Earth Day. These big environmental problems, in particular climate change, but that's not the only one, of course, are not getting the attention they deserve. And the scientific community has been clear about how serious these problems are for a long time. But the problem is political. There hasn't been the attention from the political community. They have not adequately paid attention to these challenges, and we're way behind the eight ball now. We're way behind where we ought to be in tackling these problems.
kids today, they're facing a frightening future. They're scared. They're mad at adults for neglecting the problem. We've heard of a number of places where kids are boycotting school to protest and demand action from their government leaders. At what point does it become irreparable, or has that already happened to some degree?
Well, without a doubt, we're already experiencing human-caused climate change. That's past. We can't stop the climate changes that are already in the works, but we can certainly stop them from getting worse and worse. And I think it's incredibly good news, this activism on the part of the younger generation, that is going to have to live with the consequences of what we, the older generation, have failed to deal with. And the school strikes in Europe and in the United States, and the marches and the protests in London going on right now with the Extinction Rebellion, I think that's all good news. It's moving us in the right direction. You know, it's a consequence of the fact that we've let it get this bad, and now the next generation is waking up. And I'm delighted to see that, and I'm just sorry it hasn't happened earlier.
That is a good point, that it hasn't happened earlier, and now it's getting to be a situation where even the UN chief is saying this is a defining issue of our time. We only have so much time left to fix this before things could really get ugly. We've already been hearing about wildlife disappearing. Pretty bad case scenarios. If we only have just over a decade left for the best case scenario, we've got the issue of plastic that is just unbelievable to hear that we're sort of just now waking up to all this stuff. But if we protest and we have kids getting active and lawmakers don't do anything, how do we stay hopeful?
If lawmakers still don't do anything, and I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, we see lawmakers around the world taking action. The United States is a little bit of an outlier now because we have such a right-wing anti-environment government at the moment. But even there, not all of this is under their control. There's free markets, and people are putting solar panels on their roofs, and wind turbines are going up faster than ever before. There is progress being made, but if the politicians continue to fail to act, the consequences get worse. There are three options. We can adapt to the climate changes we can't prevent any longer. We can act to try and prevent the climate changes that are going to be so bad we can't adapt to them, or we're going to suffer. And it's really just a question of the balance among those three options. Reduce greenhouse gas emissions, adapt to climate change, or suffer. And the more we do to mitigate emissions, the less adaptation we have to do and the less suffering we have to do. But again, we're acting too slowly. And we already see the consequences of our failure to act. And all we can do now is push, 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 and try and speed up the process to get off of fossil fuels and the other problems that we face. We have to offer the kids hope. We have to support them in every way possible. I'm a member of the scientific community. I'm completely behind what they're doing. I think that's a great way to help educate the public, to help mobilize the public. And we have to act as though every day is a crisis. It's not just Earth Day. And it's great that there's more attention on Earth Day, but it's got to be every day of the year. And I'm cautiously optimistic we're moving in that direction. But again, we need to move faster.
All right. That is Peter Glick, a climate scientist, environmentalist, and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. Monday was the start of World Immunization Week. We're going to focus on a disease that could be eradicated from the earth just like smallpox was. And as international programs are steadily doing with polio. But instead, we hear from Carol Pearson, this deadly disease is making a comeback.
Measles is a disease that is found only in humans, so it could be completely wiped off the face of the earth, just like smallpox was. But despite a highly effective and safe vaccine, measles is making a comeback. In just the first 3 months of this year, the World Health Organization reports that cases of measles has tripled over last year. In Africa, the situation is worse. Africa saw a 700% increase compared to last year.
Madagascar has almost 1,000 deaths. It has, you know, tens of thousands of infections.
This is Brooklyn, New York, where a measles outbreak among Hasidic Jews prompted the mayor to declare a state of emergency. The National Institutes of Health warns that a decline in measles vaccination is causing a preventable global resurgence of this often deadly disease, including in the U.S. Before the vaccine became available in the 1960s, about 2 million people around the world would die from measles. In the U.S., 3 to 4 million people were infected every year.
One in 10 children who get infected with measles will get an ear infection that could cause deafness. 1 in 20 would get pneumonia. 1 in 1,000 would get brain swelling, what we call encephalitis, and 1 to 3 per 1,000 would die. So to say that measles is a trivial disease is completely incorrect.
The complications are even worse in poor countries.
You start off with children who are already at greater risk. They may be malnourished. They may have immune system compromise. They may have underweight, and they may have no access to health care. So measles is a big killer.
You have a 90% chance of getting measles if you haven't been vaccinated and you come in contact with someone who has it.
So it's very infectious. And so it will find everybody who is not protected against measles.
The solution is to get 2 doses of the measles vaccine. That may mean educating parents about the disease and the vaccine. Equally important is making vaccination a priority of health systems worldwide. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. It is a tradition in some families for boys to join the Boy Scouts of America, and now it's becoming a new tradition for girls, too. In February, girls were officially allowed to join all activities in the Boy Scouts, now called Scouts BSA, to reflect the change. But the girls and boys are in separate troops. VOA's Deborah Block visited 2 all-girl troops in the Washington, D.C. area to see how they are liking the Scouts so far.
On this windy day here in Washington, D.C., these girls are trying to start a campfire, the same way the boys would in Scouts BSA. Sophie Schell discovers it's easier said than done.
I thought it would be a cool opportunity to practice my leadership skills to get better at leading.
There are about 40 all-girl troops in the Washington, D.C. area, now known as Scouts BSA instead of Boy Scouts,
yes,
to reflect the change in separate troops for boys and girls from 11 to 17 years old. Craig Berthart says when his daughter asked to join Scouts BSA, he became the scoutmaster for the troop in Washington.
It's a program that is very, very adaptable to girls. These girls jumped into this program with more enthusiasm, really, than I've seen in any other scouting unit.
Including Olivia Hurley, who decided to join because her brother is in scouting.
I think I'm going to be able to get out of more life skills. I like being with all girls because it gives us opportunity to learn about each other and to empower each other.
But admitting girls into Boy Scouts has angered Girl Scouts of the USA, which calls Girl Scouts the world's single best leadership development program for girls. The organization is suing the Boy Scouts of America for changing Boy Scouts to Scouts BSA. Here in Arlington, Virginia, the girls in this troop are reciting the Scouts BSA oath and getting lessons on first aid and knot tying.
This one over there, when you're going camping, you're using ropes to like help carry stuff.
As well as learning how to properly fold the American flag. Scoutmaster Megan Thomas says the girls are jumping into the program head first.
They're excited to be pioneers in being a part of an all-girl troop.
Like other girls, her daughter Sophie said she joined because she thinks the Boy Scouts are more adventurous than the Girl Scouts.
It gives us more opportunities to go out into the outdoors and like show that just because we're girls doesn't mean we can't go hiking or camping.
But her sister Corbett decided to remain in Girl Scouts too.
They both have different activities that they do. So I enjoy both of them, and I didn't want to quit one just to join the other.
Assistant Scoutmaster Mark Spruels hopes his three daughters will become an Eagle Scout, just like he did, achieving scouting's highest rank.
I'd like them to be confident in themselves and be able to handle any situation.
And as Scouts BSA says, become the best version of themselves they can be. Deborah Block, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
The memoir Prince was working on at the time of his death is coming out in October. The Beautiful Ones is said to be a deeply personal account of how Prince Rogers Nelson became the Prince we knew. A real-time story of a kid absorbing the world around him and creating a persona, an artistic vision, and a life before the hits and the fame came to define him. The book will span from Prince's childhood to his early years as a musician to the cusp of international stardom, using Prince's own writings and a scrapbook of his personal photos and original handwritten lyric sheets for many of his most iconic songs, including Purple Rain. Beautiful Ones will include an introduction by New Yorker writer Dan Pippenbring, whom Prince had chosen as a collaborator. It'll touch upon Prince's final days, a time when Prince is said to have been thinking deeply about how to reveal more of himself while retaining his mystique. Prince died 3 years ago on April 21st from an accidental overdose at the age of 57. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Seem to make up your mind. I think you better close it. Let me guide you.